Hello?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Paul Cure. I'm with the Department of the Treasury, also known as the fundraising board for the CWA. Obviously, today is going to be pretty rich in regards to the topic of conversation coming up next. And I know I've often been asked at the gym how to donate to the CWA. I'm here to help you with that. You can also hit the donate now on the CWA app, that we've all been using. Also, at the end of this session, ushers and I will be at the doors handing out donation envelopes if you're so inclined. But most importantly, thank you so much for coming and enjoy the panel.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. My name is Adam Chase, and I'll be your moderator today. And we have a very interesting topic. I guess for introduction purposes, it's just locker room talk is the name of the topic. And I've actually asked all the panelists what their locker room experiences have been. I actually grew up here in Boulder and went to Baseline. It was back then was Baseline Junior High. I actually went to Uni Hill right across the street as well. And they used to, on Mondays, the first Monday of every month, they would have to, we'd have to do the 15-minute run, and that was, and then there were forced showers afterwards, and it was, I was prepubescent until about 2 years ago, so this was, it was a bad experience in my mind. Locker rooms have always been the dread center, so, you know, just the name locker room has, you know, brings up a lot of fear, so. So, our first speaker, and we'll just go down the row. Mary Reynolds Thompson grew up in the UK, and she says she was locker room deprived, and she's not upset about that, but she did have to take tepid baths in just inches of water.
Very rare baths we were allowed.
Once a week.
Once a week baths.
Yeah. And then Valerie Simons is here from the university. She's a Title IX compliance expert. And works actually with a little bit, well, knows my law firm, works a lot with some of the people from my law firm who are Title IX specialists. So kind of a fun meeting. Sam Cook is here from Minneapolis, and he avoided locker rooms in junior high, high school, and college, so smart man. And then Karuna Jagger was a rower, so she had probably as much, but at a women's college, so not the locker room experience that we'll probably be talking about. So without any more delay, let's get started with Mary Reynolds Thompson. Thank you.
It's a good afternoon, everyone. The author, Jane Austen, said that she'd never write a scene with just men talking to each other because she doesn't or didn't have a clue what men would talk about when women weren't present. So I don't have a clue what men talk about when women aren't present, right? But this whole idea that somehow it's just locker room talk implies that it's absolutely fine if that talk, if men are saying things about women and it's somehow in this closed, shut space, right? That somehow, if women don't hear about it, if it doesn't get out into the bigger and larger world, then what the heck? What harm does it do? So, you know, one of the big questions is, does it actually matter what we talk about when the people we're talking about aren't present? Do you really think that women aren't harmed if men denigrate them when they're just hanging around with each other? I mean, it's a question, right? But of course, it wasn't in a locker room. And it wasn't just anybody who said what he said. This was our now President Trump, a role model for young men and men everywhere, who said it on the way to an afternoon soap opera on a bus, and it got recorded. And we now have all heard the words. And I want to presence those words here in this room because, quite honestly, they are chilling. I moved on her like a bitch, but I couldn't get there. And she was married. Then all of a sudden, I see her. Now she's got these big, phony tits and everything. I mean, just take a moment to hear those words. I'm automatically attracted to beautiful women. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. Just kiss, I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. Grab them by the pussy. You can do anything. So this really is also a statement of power and domination, right? It's like, I am a powerful man, and therefore I can do anything I want to a woman, and I can get away with it. So I spent a lot of time, too much time, last election cycle on Facebook, listening to all that was going on. And one of the things that happened was that women's trauma from sexual assault really got triggered. I mean, here was somebody running to be president of this country who was overheard saying these things, and somehow that didn't stop him in his tracks. So what was happening was a lot of women were being re-traumatized, and they were beginning to share their stories on Facebook. And there was this amazing Canadian writer, Kelly Oxford, who started this campaign, It's Not Okay. It was a tweet campaign, actually. And what she invited was women to tell of their first experience of sexual assault. And I want to share some of those things because I think it's really important to get this perspective. I won't give details, but I was 12 and he went to jail. Sorry. I've spent the last 20 minutes thinking I should delete my not okay tweets because I don't want people to think I'm damaged. 35-year-old hairdresser offers to drive me home, shoves his tongue down my throat. I'm 15. He'd been cutting my hair since I was 9. 10 years old, gymnastics coach grabbed me by the pussy. My grand uncle gropes my breasts, telling me how lucky my boyfriends will be and how I'm growing so fast. I'm 14. Tried to tell doctor about an assault when I was 10 years old. His response, boys will be boys. Then he shamed me for overreacting. I wish I could talk about it. So I think when I was looking through these tweets, what I was really sensing is how this damage is embodied in women as shame and silence. That we have really been afraid to tell our stories of sexual assault, of physical assault, because we haven't been listened to, because people in positions in power, particularly men in positions of power, have told us we either brought it along ourselves, we didn't dress appropriately, we were drunk, you know, you're over-exaggerating, boys will be boys. I do a lot of work with women's circles, and I've also spent a lot of time, over 3 decades now, in recovery. And the UN says that 1 in 3 women have been sexually assaulted. My experience is it's probably a lot higher than that. And what happens is a piece of our soul gets stolen. So that we lose confidence in ourselves, we lose our self-esteem, we lose the ability to feel our own truth. And if male talk is happening in locker rooms or whatever sealed circles, the truth of it is that women's truth is getting locked up in their hearts. They don't know how to speak it. And so I think one of the incredibly important things that is happening is that women are beginning to find the courage to tell their stories. And what we're finding out is it is a frighteningly common story, one that so many of us share. And it affects everything. It affects our relationships to the world, to our work, to our health, to our ability to have loving and fulfilling relationships and partnerships later in life. There is nothing, I think, more damaging than hurting or taking someone's body and using it for your own purpose. That is a kind of stealing and taking possession that is the ugliest, most soul-destroying that there is. This is not just locker room talk. It's piggery and it's thievery and it's disgusting. And we should be in an absolute uproar, as we are. You know, women are rising and speaking, and good men are rising and speaking with them. And it's difficult because this is a risky conversation that we have to sit down with and speak to our bosses and our partners and our colleagues and have this conversation about what it means to be sexual beings in this world, right? How do we relate to each other? How do we work with each other? And so there's this sense that men and women have to come together and talk, really talk, from the depths of their heart and the depths of their vulnerability. Because I don't for a moment believe that men do these things because that's their nature to do those things. Somewhere along the line, a message got instilled in them that that's what it is to be a guy. You know, that's okay. I don't believe that this is just boys will be boys. I don't believe that for a moment. So we have to have this deeper conversation. And it has to begin with unlocking our hearts and getting it out of all the locked places into common space and shared space. Muriel Rukeyser, the poet, says, "If a woman was to speak her truth about her life, the world would split open." You know? Every time we can get to that level of truth, the world changes. So I want to end actually with a poem by Marge Piercy, who's a marvelous feminist poet for you. And I think she really speaks in this poem to the kind of space that we need to create for the kind of conversation that has to happen. So Councils by Marge Piercy. We must sit down together and reason together. We must sit down. Men standing want to hold forth. They rain down upon faces lifted. We must sit down on the floor, on the earth, on stones and mats and blankets. There must be no front to the speaking, no platform, no rostrum, no stage or table. We will not crane to see who is speaking. Perhaps we should sit in the dark. In the dark, we could utter our feelings. In the dark, we could propose and describe and suggest. In the dark, we could not see who speaks, and only the words would say what they say. Thus saying what we feel and what we want, what we fear for ourselves and each other into the dark. Perhaps we could begin to listen. Perhaps we should talk in groups, small enough for everyone to speak. Perhaps we should start by speaking softly. The women must learn to dare to speak. The men must bother to listen. The women must learn to say, "I think this is so." The men must learn to stop dancing solos on the ceiling. After each speaks, she or he will repeat a ritual phrase. It is not I who speaks, but the wind. Wind blows through me. Long after me is the wind.
Thank you. That's going to be tough to follow. I really appreciate that in so many levels. Can you hear me okay? Okay, I was going to say, I don't know if that's on. Thank you. I just said that's going to be tough to follow. I just can't even tell you how much I appreciate those words and perspective. You know, and I certainly come from a legal perspective. I've been a civil rights attorney for quite some time, but it really strikes me the first reaction that I have when I hear locker room talk, obviously from our now president. What do I tell my kids? What do I tell my kids? You know, I have a 12-year-old girl, 16-year-old boy, and I every day do a job that requires, you know, it's a fight. It is a true challenge that I accept, but it is a true challenge to say every day, we've got to do better. We have to do better. We can't accept anything less. And to hear that and to do what I do for 20 years and say, I don't know how to talk to you about this. And I'm getting emotional because it's hard. And I don't ever, as people know. But it's hard. It's hard to say, when you hear that, where have we come as a country? You know, to feel like my entire professional career has been dedicated to civil rights and the enforcement of civil rights, and then to have to tell my 12-year-old daughter, I think we've just stepped back, you know, quite dramatically. That is so frustrating, obviously, to everyone. So I really appreciated the phrase, how do we speak it? Because I think that's so important, is how do we speak it? How do we share the stories? Which, again, I love that phrase, because I think that is something that we deal with in my office every day, is how do we encourage people to come forward with their situations, what's happening to them. You know, I have an office here, so just as brief background, because I think that's going to help in terms of my perspective, is I'm here at CU Boulder. I'm what's called a Title IX coordinator, but I'm also the executive director of an office that its entire purpose is to ensure, really, the ideals and philosophies of our civil rights laws. We do investigations, we do education and prevention, we do what's called remedial measures. But it is an attempt to ensure that the entire process allows people to speak, allows people to come forward. You know, this is really what I have spent my entire career focusing on. You know, I went to, you know, and let me step back even one step further, is that, you know, the idea of this, especially when you're talking about my focus, which is public education, both as a student or as an employee, is access, okay? Because when you talk locker room talk, you have hostile talk in any place, locker room, classroom, office, outside the office, you know, those kinds of things are denying people access to the things that they should have the right to, you know, go to school, go to work, things like that. And that's really the philosophy of everything I'm about. And that starts so early, you know, and as I said, I talked to my kids about how to really process this, is that I grew up in Denver. I was bused in Denver. I was part of the desegregation case in Denver. And so from a very early age, I've been aware of ways in which there are barriers, okay? It can be obviously verbal, it can be physical, it can be both, and oftentimes is, but ensuring that those barriers are down, that people have access to that. And so, you know, after I went to school at high school, you know, elementary through high school, went to schools that were struggling with really to ensure access for everybody in many ways and a lot of forms of discrimination. And so then worked at Department of Justice where I was at the Civil Rights Division Education Section, and we enforced all the civil rights laws, you know, pertaining to public institutions, private on the higher education front, to really ensure, you know, when we hear this, what's the response to it? Because just as important is not only that victims are sharing, but there's an appropriate response, which is just as important, obviously. And that's been my realm for most of my career. And so, you know, I did that at Justice. I did that in private practice, where I represented primarily students and their parents, you know, who had suffered forms of discrimination and harassment. Again, Title IX, but not just Title IX. So really brought that perspective here to ensure that we have a process where not only people can speak, but that they are heard and that there's an appropriate response, which is just as important. So locker room talk is incredibly impactful. I think it also was very poignant to say, you know, it's not okay, you know, when it's just in the locker room between them, because that means that it's happening everywhere else that they're going. It's not going to be limited to that context. So we've got to be able to address it. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Two tough acts to follow. I really wanted to take a moment and thank Mary for bringing that language, those words, both that hate speech and the responses into this room and embodying them and giving them voice. And I wanted to give another round of applause. It takes a lot to do that. And thank you so much. So I come to this. I'm a performing poet and a publisher, and I work with a lot of people who tell stories that aren't allowed to break into the mainstream. And so this is something that's growing in culture, or whatever, this issue of toxic masculinity. I also think it's important to call hate speech and not to you know, beat around the bush or whatever. I think that's what Mary read for us, is a statement of hate speech. I think it's literally violence. That is violence, and I don't have any question about that. So I think that one of the most important things we've been talking about is how we either personally or systemically deconstruct the systems that produce this, right? And I think that the number one issue, before we even get into how you do that, is if you look at the systems that try to deconstruct, you know, stuff like this, the burden of work is almost entirely put on women. The expectation is that women will fix this, that women will put the hours in, and they'll fix men or something. Mm-hmm. And I think that's astonishingly hateful, and I think the fact that that's a subtext in almost all the work I see around this should make us all as men ashamed. I don't do enough. Most men don't do enough. I know there are a few of us that do, but it is so common to see oppressors put the burden of fixing the problem on the oppressed, and I think it's bullshit, and I no questions about it. I work with a really impressive poet and activist named Kyle Tranmire. He also goes by Guante. He spoke at the UN on toxic masculinity last year, and I'm going to read a poem of his for you guys, as it's about the male role in a lot of this stuff, and, you know, it's called Action. There is a conversation that never happened, not even a deleted scene, more like a storyboard lost, an idea cut from the first draft. You are co-starring, slouched on the futon while we are watching the game, telling me about your new girlfriend, or more specifically, all the things you're going to do to your new girlfriend. Action. And part of me still remembers my lines, even though I never said them. The conversation I just couldn't start for fear of awkwardness or hurting our friendship, or simply because the commercials were over. That one tiny gesture that might not have changed anything, but might have. I remember how I never muted the TV, never put my drink down, and never said, "Man, the way you talk about her, the way you treat her, your hands are getting too big for your heart. I can smell the future on your breath. She isn't safe with you." And now it's 2 weeks later, and we're standing in my kitchen, that same silence between us. She didn't want to press charges, so you're a convict with sledgehammer hands and no boulders to break them on. And I am thinking about how we used to play football together, numbers 55 and 56, both inside linebackers. I am remembering the dozens of conversations that never happened, the words oversleeping in the bed of my lungs. I am the least important person in this story. And part of me wants to believe that you wouldn't have listened anyway, that some evil spirit whispered itself into your skull. Part of me wants to believe that we didn't grow up three blocks from each other, that our eyes aren't the same color. Part of me is always repeating those lines, always shooting the scene, always reminding myself that despite this guilt, I'm not a bad guy. You tell me that she never said no, that you're sorry, that you're not a bad guy. Rape culture is silence. It is being able to see the future and not do anything about it. It is believing the fairy tale platitude that there are good people and bad people, and that as long as you are not one of the bad people, your job is done, your conscience is clear. It is all of us swimming through the same polluted water of beer commercials policing masculinity, and stand-up comedians making rape jokes to sound edgy, and media talking heads blaming the victim, and music turning women into disposable sex objects, and language incurring us to think of sex as violence, bang, hit, smash. It is telling our daughters to dress sensibly and not walk alone at night, and telling our sons. It's a conversation that never happened. And this is not an excuse for you. It is a reminder from me that while her silence will always mean no, my silence, this silence between us, will always mean yes. So, I guess the thing that I really want to bring into this space and into this dialogue is that this, if you ever are confronted with someone or a situation that suggests implicitly or explicitly that what you're in, this is a women's issue, it's bullshit, like I said earlier, and you have to do something about it. If you take yourself seriously in this space and you came here on purpose, that should be a conflict of interest. It should be something you can't be both at the same time. And I hope that's true for everybody here.
Well, another hard act to follow. So is it just locker room talk? We all know the answer, right? So anybody who has any doubts can step to the side. We'll talk to you offline. But we're not going to use the space of the whole to talk about that. We know it's a problem. You know, our thoughts, our speech reflects our thoughts. Our thoughts determine our actions. And this is the window into how portions of our communities are speaking. And we need to, you know, as you're saying, create a space where communities are holding each other accountable. This is more than just sexism. It's more than just misogyny. It's about racism, it's about transphobia, it's about all kinds of issues. And so we all need to step up to the plate when it comes to people that look and look like us, that come from our communities, and are invested in oppression, speech, and physical and violent oppressions. So I'm sorry, you know, it's we're sort of creating this as we go, and I feel like, you know, when I sat down to think about this panel, and yesterday I was leaving the conference, and I checked in on Twitter and saw the shootings in San Bernardino. And I thought, you know, we don't need to talk about, is it just locker room talk? We know it's not just locker room talk. We know that, you know, what men say about women matters. And we know that violence against women is prevalent. So yesterday, Karen Elaine Smith was shot and killed by her estranged husband in a classroom. Some of the students were shot. One of them died. Last week, where I come from in Richmond, I come from Berkeley, but in Richmond, California, Rashonda Franklin was shot by her estranged boyfriend in front of her children again. The violence against women is prevalent, and I think we're so, you know, Trump says it's just locker room talk, it's distracting from the real issues. What makes employment rates more important than sexual assault rates, more important than murder rates? Why are we allowing ourselves to focus on employment as the measure of our country's success and well-being?
feel like, you know, the panelists have said so much that I was sort of going to touch on so much more eloquently than me. I think I want to just end it there and open it up to your questions.
We're first going to have some interpanel discussion, but how many of you have the app? Okay, if you want, you can send questions through the app, and if you need a card, just raise your hand, and then you can write down questions. Thank you. Did any of you have points you wanted to make with one another?
I was really fascinated, Sam, when you said, because I hadn't thought about it this way, and when you said it, it really clicked for me, that the oppressor looks to the oppressed to fix the situation. Mm-hmm. And I realized, you know, how much, as you said, women have been asked to step in and fix all kinds of things. You know, the marriage isn't going well, you know, issues with the kids, you know, just, and so I'm just curious what people feel about this balance of taking responsibility but not stepping into this place of becoming the fixer. I mean, it's a really, it's not an easy demarcation, right?
I mean, you know, your point is a good one because this isn't just about sexism, right? Mm-hmm. It's also about racism. You know, people of color are supposed to either, you know, in one version, make white people feel comfortable, in another version, teach white people how, you know, various right. things are offensive. And so it's all, you know, this is I think an important point. And you know, what I had planned to talk about, which you spoke about ever so much more eloquently than me, is the role of the bystander, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to allow that sort of talk in your proximity? Mm-hmm. You know, we all bear a responsibility of speaking up. And I think the responsibility of holding power, of being privileged in certain ways, gives us more responsibility to speak up, speak mm-hmm. out, to challenge forms of oppression, to challenge, you know, various isms, and so I think it's putting power into the equation mm-hmm. and acknowledging intersectionality.
I can certainly talk. I think there are a couple points that I wanted to raise. Is one of the, you know, trends, especially with respect to Title IX in particular, was the push from victims of sexual assault that really came to the fore, you know, particularly 2013, 2014, and I think the point's well taken in terms of much of the response that came was really because victims of sexual assault were taking it on their own, unfortunately, to solve the problem. And you saw as a result, you know, there's lots of examples, but in, you know, that time you have, you know, the White House Task Force coming out, you have the Department of Education, Office for Civil Rights, you know, all of a sudden there's a response to primarily victims who first took it to the, you know, took it to their schools and there was not an appropriate response, and then Department of Education and really going public, using the media, you know, Hunting Ground is certainly an example, where really took it upon themselves and really created quite a tidal wave, you know, in this area. I mean, there has been, you know, it is an example is the Dear Colleague letter, you know, there's a Dear Colleague letter that came out in this area in, you know, 2001 that really set the stage for where we are now, and then there's another one that comes out in 2011. It's still pretty quiet, you know, nationally speaking, and then all of a sudden you have a lot of victims of sexual assault coming forward. And then you see really, you know, where we have to remain. And I think that is what is so crucial in that area is we cannot lose the momentum that that has created. And the change, and certainly, you know, the change that has happened on this campus, but I think nationwide to say this remains a priority. We cannot, and you know, and there's certainly in a world with a lot of priorities, this cannot be lost. And I think that that is my sort of ever concern, is people ask me a lot, they said, well, do you, how does that feel to have that pressure and that constant microscope? And I say, we have to keep that, because if we don't, people won't feel comfortable coming forward. We won't have the appropriate response. We've got to keep it. And so that was, you know, I think even legally speaking, that has really come to the forefront. With respect to bystander, especially if you're familiar with Title IX and really any kind of education program, that is the name of the game. You know, bystander education is the primary way in which we educate people to first know it when you hear it. And that's really, you know, when people say, oh, I know locker room talk and I know that. But that's so incredible, is not only know it when you hear it, but to build skill sets, okay? Especially when we're talking to, you know, my community here is, you know, students, and certainly in the high school level, even going down to elementary school level, is how to really process that, how to use your own skill set, develop your own skills, and to do something about it. You know, and I think that's one of the things we do have. Please check it out. We have a Don't Ignore It campaign. It's an entirely separate campaign about really how to hear it and take the appropriate response. And that can be really different sometimes to different people. Some people, like probably everybody on this panel, is going to say, I'm reporting that now. You know, I'm going to go to the right office because I am so enraged by that. Some people are like, I'm not quite sure how to deal with this. And so really it meets you where you are, but to address the behavior. So I think bystander is such a good point.
Can I just thank you for that? I think it's really, it's important to talk about training, right? You know, we live in oppressive structures and we do have unequal power. And so I just wanted to add to that, you know, we can't get into some simplistic world like, worldview where all men have power and their power is equal and they oppress women, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, Adam, you know, you kind of alluded to the ways in which patriarchy is oppressive to men and the ways in which locker rooms are not safe for many men. And we need to acknowledge that as well, that in, you know, a lot of this locker room talk, while, you know, speaking disparagingly of women or people of color, whomever, you know, gay people, whatever, also carries with it a lot of other kind of power dynamic in the face-to-face interpersonal between those men. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, recognizing that, the complexity, and building some skill sets around it and support structures around it is important.
Mm-hmm. Can I actually speak to that for a second, to the locker room thing? As a dude who avoided locker rooms as I was introduced, I did that. I didn't take any PE classes in high school. I went to high school here in Boulder, also Boulder, Colorado, this incredibly liberal, wonderful place. I didn't go through puberty until I was about 15, maybe 15 and a half. I haven't halved myself since I was 8. I was about 5'2", and I grew basically no hair anywhere, and my peers mocked me ceaselessly. I was tortured, and that torture was a way to force me to participate in shaming other people. And that's a whole big part of the equation, is that you are shamed and pushed out, and you're allowed in as soon as you're willing to participate in this other hate speech. So it's like you play this game, and it validates all of us. And it's like, I'm not saying it happens for everyone everywhere. There's got to be other cultures. I don't want to say that every locker room is the same, but that was my lived experience, and it's really weird. It on paper, as I say it out loud, is a very similar map to how you build cults. You know, you like you torment someone, you put them through incredible stress, and then you give them something they can say to fit in. You know, and you all laugh together and party together or whatever, and it works. It works. I watched young men who were gentle young men come out and say things to me in other contexts that were just shocking. And I was like, oh, cool, we're not the same anymore. And like, I managed to keep some of those friendships, but it's something that is complex and real, and that there really is a lot of pressure put on young men, especially if they don't fit into this standard of male power or whatever, you know? Anyway, I just wanted to bring that into the room a little bit. It's real. But it doesn't necessarily engender or support violence against anybody. I just want to make sure that's also there, that it may suck, but there's nobody telling you to go like assault anyone. That was never a part of the context. It may, at least in my life, it was a celebration of hate, perhaps, but not of violence. And I think it's an important demarcation to make.
Sam, could you repeat the name of the poet?
Oh, absolutely. Kyle Tran Myrie, and he also goes by Guante. You can, let me give you his website really fast, because he would love that. He is, it's just www.guante, guante.info. Oh, sorry, I'm so fast. www. dot G-U-A-N-T-E dot I-N-F-O. That's info. Cool. And he's, look him up. He's really, really incredible. Does very incredible work.
Well, we have some amazing questions, actually a lot of them, and we won't get to all of them, so I apologize ahead of time. First, I think for Valerie, someone asked a pretty simple question, but a good one. What is Title IX?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Great question. You know, I get in conversations where people are so familiar with it that I forget. Sometimes I have to step back. Perfect question. So Title IX is a civil rights law. It was, who knows when it was passed? 72. So it is a law that prohibits sex discrimination, okay? And this is where some people get kind of caught up. It's not just against women, okay? It's against anybody, okay, on the basis of sex. And that's important to know. Obviously, the precursor for this was an environment that did not provide equal opportunities, okay, in many ways. So any, you know, institution that receives federal financial assistance, and that typically means K through 12, that just means public for K through 12, colleges, universities, that typically includes public and privates, they cannot discriminate on the basis of sex in any of their programs, okay? And that in any way that might deny someone, that's what I was talking about, opportunities and access, that someone might be denied an opportunity to go to school, you know, do any other extracurricular programs, things like that. Passed in 1972, not a lot of action for some time, but then I think most of the questions, especially initially as I get is, all you do is sports, talk about locker rooms, okay? That's a different way to talk about locker rooms, is Title IX was first really primarily enforced in the gender equity context, okay? Assuring that men and women had equal opportunities. That means, you know, in terms of interests and abilities, that you were accommodating interests and abilities, that financial assistance was being provided, and then what they call the laundry list. I did not come up with that name, but that's the name everybody uses. I don't particularly like it because it seems kind of gendered in a way. The locker or the laundry list is all the other things that you might have in sports. So locker rooms, of course, is the big one. Any other kind of facilities, coaches, all of that thing, and so. That was a big component of Title IX for quite some time, is the sports context, is making sure that there's equity, okay? And that's, again, K through 12 and colleges, universities, including CU Boulder. Fast forward a little bit, and then you come to the 1990s, where the Supreme Court gets involved and looks at harassment, okay, between peers, between students, peer-on-peer harassment. And it starts to get into, and there's some Supreme Court cases, and I'll try to be really fast, that talk about really an institution, you know, who's covered under Title IX, if they know about harassment between students, you know, sex-based in this context, and are deliberately indifferent, if they're on notice about it and deliberately indifferent to it, and it's what's called severe or pervasive, objectively offensive, and they do nothing, then you're going to have a problem, okay? And so it really, for the first time, puts responsibilities on these primarily public, you know, but private in the K through or the university context, puts them really having the responsibility, even though one of their employees, for example, might not have perpetrated this, but someone at like a student to student context. And so you really have this world in which, you know, sexual harassment is prohibited. And then you go forward in terms of the Department of Education, Office for Civil Rights, who has the primary administrative enforcement for Title IX, is they start coming out with guidance about what this looks like. And when I talked about Dear Colleague letters, you see the 2001 is really important, 2011 is really important. It starts to give guidance about the context of sexual assault, okay? Obviously the most extreme form of sexual harassment. And so you get a world in which we live now in terms of the really very significant responsibilities of these institutions to address this and address it as quickly as they can. And so just the final thing is that the law does require each institution to have a Title IX coordinator who really coordinates the efforts in this way, and that is myself here at CU Boulder.
And as a follow-up to that, someone asks, are the bystander intervention exercises and prevention programs, sexual assault prevention programs, taking effect and have they had an impact here at CU?
It's a great question. I don't know, I think, is the answer to that. We did a very big sexual misconduct survey for folks here in Boulder. You've probably read about it. We did it a fall ago, you know, 2015 fall, came out with the results last spring, fall to spring, in terms of what our numbers are, how effective our programming has been. But that was really simultaneously with the launch of many of our programs. And so that's why we will be surveying every 4 years at this point. To really determine how our programs are landing, because that's, you know, if they're not working, then we're going to change. I mean, that's just have to be the name of the game.
So there's a couple themes and questions here, so I'll try to kind of weave them together. One is we've been talking mostly about the U.S. And how about this culture and machismo and catcalling and other societies and communities outside of the U.S. How do we address that? Or do we address that?
I can only speak to England, so that's the only other experience I have. But I would say certainly we could look at this as a Western problem. I don't know anything about, I mean, we know all over the world, women are being oppressed, right? I mean, we know that. I mean, we look to the Middle East, we look to all kinds of cultures, and we see that the oppression of women is pervasive. And I'm sure it takes different qualities and all kinds of different complexities that are involved. But certainly in the West, it does feel deeply connected to this sense of patriarchy. And I feel in a way that Trump is a grotesque symbol for the dying, for the slow death of patriarchy. That's the only good news I can feel in this. And bringing tremendous courage, but it is I mean, I don't know, anybody else have experience of different cultures?
From my perspective, the one thing that's very important, which is specific to CU Boulder, is we have a sizable international community. So while I can't speak to you know, what may be going on internationally specific, and Title IX doesn't apply outside the, you know, United States, so can't really speak to that. But we do find that we have to ensure that we are training and we are conscious, very, of different cultural norms. I would say that comes out certainly in the sexual assault context, the idea of what's consent, lots of different cultural norms about that. I'd say the things that come up most often is the victim didn't say no, so I thought we were good to go. And so that's certainly not okay under our policies and most policies in the United States for colleges. And that has come up, I think, frequently. It certainly comes up with our domestic students as well, but I think it does also come up in the international students. I think another place that it has come up is in the context of intimate partner violence. That, I think, is probably most akin to different cultural norms. I mean, I think that is, you know, and now I'm talking about dating domestic violence, I'm also talking about stalking. So things that the Violence Against Women Act is really designed to address is that's where there's been, I think, a bigger disconnect in our international community. And so, you know, and that's one of the reasons that I have combined in our office. So not only do we have the investigative side where we are, you know, obviously investigating the complaints of all of these things, but it's also now informing our training. And so that's when those were never connected before. And that's actually kind of unusual, if you can believe it. That sounds strange saying out loud. But I think in most colleges, there's a separate education piece and a separate investigation place. There's like separate offices that do it. And so the reason that we combine that is so we can really be very collaborative, and so we can learn what is coming up in the investigation so we know, you know, for the educators, so that when they go out, they do the bystander, bystander is mandatory on this campus. I think we may be the only one, and we do it in person, which is, again, kind of rare, and to make sure that we are understanding some potentially cultural international lenses, which really come out in those contexts.
This is my fourth panel of the week, and this is the third panel that's been all white. I've otherwise been on panels with white people and one Latina woman. And I think that's going to inform our, we need to acknowledge that, we need to stay in our lane to some respect. And so I'm going to kind of take a little sideways step with this, which is I lived and studied in Tanzania for a couple of years. I was at the University of Dar es Salaam as an undergraduate, and then later I did graduate research at the University of Dar es Salaam, so it's East Africa, if you don't know. And what I can say, it kind of brings some complexity to this, is sure, there are forms of, you know, oppression for women, there's violence against women, absolutely. But as a white woman, I was some other category, right? As a white woman, maybe I was male, maybe I was something else. And so I think we need to kind of acknowledge that, especially when we're dealing with other cultures and international issues, you know, there's a rich interplay. And you know, as Western white women with money and privilege going into other countries, we have different experiences.
I think you mentioned that this honor killing business in India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan terrifies any woman who's willing to step outside of her male family. Mm-hmm. And it puts a dimension in this conversation which you brought up, asking, you know, put up as international. It's a world terror.
So I was lucky enough to speak on a TEDx panel with one named Mona Al-Tahawi. And sorry about that. And I'll spell that for you later. She's an incredible activist, and she speaks around the world. She was in Egypt when the Arabic uprising happened, some people call the Arab Spring, and had both of her hands broken by security forces while she was there, among other things. But she talks a lot about international violence against women. And I spoke with her, and then afterwards I'm like, hey, what can I do? What can I do as my privilege, my position, American, how can I make change? And she's like, how about you work on your country? How about you work on your place? We've got our Islamic Brotherhood, y'all got your Christian Brotherhood, and to me, they're the same thing. And I was like, what? And she's like, same thing, same thing. And that was her response, you know? So let's maybe focus here a little bit, you know? Yeah. We have some of the worst violence against women in the world. There are places that we hold up. I mean, the West has been celebrating, and I'm not saying it's not happening, but the West has been celebrating violence against women in the Middle East since, I think, the 1700s, maybe since earlier than that. But there's a lot of writing about it. Edward Said, I think, writes a lot about the exotification and celebration of these damsels, these Middle Eastern women who are being, you know, abused or whatever. And it's a much more complex story. We get little tiny pieces, you know, like we don't live there.
Yeah, and it's, you know, white imperialism, white supremacy, we can feel good because it's not bride killing.
Yeah.
But, you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay, another common theme is how do we speak about this to men and boys? And what do we tell our sons, our brothers, mm-hmm. our friends?
Okay, I'll do another one. So I, again, grew up in strange, progressive, liberal Boulder, and one of the beautiful things, this man, a number of men, but these two men, Bruce Rose and David Young. Bruce Rose was a high school counselor at Boulder High, and David Young has been a teacher at Naropa and a man who practices religion in this city for a long time. And the two of them, along with, and Carl Kalin, a group of men in this city, put together this group called Men's Eagle Council, and it was a rites of passage process for young men, and it was a way to actively say, get in front of these conversations, the locker room conversations, and force men to get together once a week, our entire junior or senior year usually, once a week, with older men, and discuss things like sex and anger and failure and shame with other men, and to not be in a place where the men are all forcing the men to be silent. And I don't think it was a silver bullet or anything. I don't think it fixed everything, but I think it's a great first start to make a space, because how many men have any kind of context in their life where they got together with other men and were forced to talk about masculinity? Anybody? Yeah, we got a couple, you know? And it should be more than that, you know? Like, why isn't, if we all know these problems are pervasive, why isn't that happening? Why aren't we getting two of our good friends together as adult men and then gathering a group of children, young people, and talking about it? And I think that especially in a place where it wasn't just one social group. It wasn't just the sports team. It wasn't just the nerds or the computer folks or the musicians. It was all these groups of young men of different identities inside of sort of one homogenous identity or whatever. And it broke down a number of boundaries, and it helped us realize that, like, there's a lot of shit messed up with masculinity. Masculinity is very unhealthy. Like, we're not managing it well as a culture or whatever. And so I'm going to stop there and say that maybe just start having those conversations in big groups with men, you know?
Yes, the conversation, for sure. And I think it really comes back to something that is sorely lacking in our society, a rites of passage. So sex, drugs, and it's not rock and roll anymore, but whatever it is the rite of passage of youth into adulthood. And that does not teach you either to stand in your feminine power or your masculine power. And so I really feel that we are failing our young people hugely by not giving them a really deep spiritual, psychological journey into adulthood and what it means to be a man or a woman in the world. Because so many of these rites of passage teach men, you know, that they're in a way there to be a protective factor for women, to really to stand into the masculinity and to feel their strength, not to protect women because they're weak in any way, but because the masculine can also stand in protection of the feminine. And so if we don't get kids of a certain age as they're moving from adolescence into adulthood, if we don't get them then, our work becomes a lot harder down the line. And I feel, you know, it's connected to so many issues that are being talked about in this conference, like, you know, college debt. When you're coming out of university and what you're worried about is just getting a job with money to pay back all that you loan, and you kind of have to compromise maybe some of your own selfhood to get work, to pay back, and everything like that, you can lose yourself in the process. And it's very much about, for both of, you know, all sexes and all people and all races, it's about what is it, power and privilege and domination and all these things that we've talked about. But unless we give our young a process through which they can discover that for themselves, we're going to continue to have these problems.
This is a question that was asked many times. Why did women vote for Trump?
I mean, let me actually turn that question on its head. Why did men vote for Trump? Women, you know, Trump assaulting women is not just a women's issue. It's an issue for our society. Why did anybody vote for Trump?
I also think, sadly, women have a history of protecting the abuser. I really do. And we have to care, and I think a lot of women did care, even the ones who voted for Trump, but they didn't care enough. So it's not just caring, it's really caring about something enough that you change your actions around it. And so they fell, I think, into something that was, well, yeah, they didn't really like it, but it wasn't that bad. It was not, yeah, wasn't that bad. And I think what we're really talking about today is, yeah, it was really, really that bad.
And I think Valerie's point is, you know, in a patriarchal misogynist society, we need to be educated about what is, you know, hate speech, what is unacceptable. And unfortunately, we have a culture that has normalized rape culture and fails to recognize it for what it is.
Mm-hmm. So that's a perfect segue to exactly what I was going to say, is that the number one reason from our sexual misconduct survey that people didn't report is they didn't find it serious enough. I mean, it is dead on. That the people who, so we had a sexual assault survey, and we sent it to all of our students on campus. We had a 41% response rate, so which is unheard of if you've ever done a survey. It's enormous. And so pretty good data that said that people who have self-identified, and this is an anonymous survey, so you know we don't identify them, and that makes it easier to take, is people who identify themselves as victims of sexual assault. The next, you know, sort of set of questions is, and did you report it? You know, either to anybody, you know, that could be my office, that could be to police. Did you talk to a, you know, confidential support person? The number one reason that people are not talking to other people about it is that they themselves, as a victim of sexual assault, did not code it as serious enough, okay? And when you look at the behavior that they are reporting to have occurred, it's extraordinary because it is quite high, okay? And so I think that in itself, this idea that people do not understand that this is serious behavior is dead on to this conversation. And that's why when we do this survey, you know, here's the sort of aha moment. I just had 13,000 people, students, go through our sexual misconduct policy, okay? 13,000 students know what consent is. They now know what incapacitation is. They know what non-consensual intercourse means, non-consensual contact. You get the drill. So it also is not only so we have data, so that I have just showed you this isn't okay. Like what we're reporting is this is not okay behavior, okay? And I can tell you, and everybody knows this, it starts with locker room talk, okay? That's where it starts, and it is a pattern that you can just see it in every case, and it's the tactics that are involved. And so ensuring that everybody knows this is not okay is it's the primary sort of function of what we do. You know, and I tell you, I had so many, you know, people talk to my office, want to know. They said, you know, I'm reading because we did a, you know, we're very public about this information because it's not only our community, it's our Boulder community, it's really our national community to sort of code this as, yes, this is serious. And I got a lot of questions. Well, that doesn't sound that serious. Mm. And I'm like, well, I'm glad you asked because I'm going to tell you it is. And that's that, but that's part of the education. And that's what, you know, you get normalized in a way. And I think that's part of this response to that question.
Here's a question from a student newspaper reporter wants to know how to address sexual assault without coming across as insensitive to the survivor's struggles. Yes, a student newspaper reporter wants to know how to address sexual assault without coming across as being insensitive to the survivor's struggles.
I mean, I think a great place is talking to human beings and asking them what they feel is sensitive or insensitive, if that's available to you. It may not, may or may not be, but if that is a possibility, you know, people will often come out if you can give them a safe way or an anonymous way to talk about what they've experienced.
I think from my perspective, we do investigations in my office, and one of the things that's very important is to be trauma-informed, okay? That means that, you know, I've talked about training of the community about, you know, prohibited conduct and how to, you know, respond to it, but just as important is training for our staff, okay? Training for everyone who comes in contact with a victim of sexual assault, and I get this question a lot, is, you know, there's a sort of, I talk about a priority of needs, okay? And when you have an allegation of sexual assault, the first need is not typically that an investigation needs to happen right that moment, okay? We are very sensitive to timing. Obviously, that's just as important. But when I talk about a priority needs is, are you okay? Okay? And so we've got to ensure that the first intake, okay, whether it's your friend, which is the number one person that people tell, is their friend, their roommate, their friend. And so our Office of Victim Assistance has a ton of training for our student body to say, you know, how to talk to a friend. I mean, that's huge. You know, how are they responding? How are university staff responding? Are you okay? Do you need medical assistance? Okay, we have a sexual assault nurse exam program now at Boulder Community Health, which is huge. And so do they have that in terms of the medical assistance? And what do you need? Counseling? Do you need help with a, you know, with a test on Monday? What do you need right now to make sure you're okay? And then we start to talk about, you know, potential investigation. But that really is sort of down the line, and I think having that mindset is really the number one factor.
I just want to observe that of the two women who were killed in through domestic violence, that I, the names that I read earlier were absent from the media stories. The names that were used were of the men who killed them. And so I think it's starting by, you know, humanizing, taking care of, attending to women, mm-hmm. and prioritizing them, centering the conversation around women.
Here's a good question. What are the metrics of progress?
I can take some of this. Certainly the data that we've gathered from our sexual misconduct survey is one piece of the data. One of the things that was very important to me when I came in is that reporting has to go up. It's almost how we started, is do people feel okay to speak and tell us what is happening? I can say that that, from an instinctual standpoint, says, wow, well, reports shouldn't go up because that means that things are getting worse. No, incidents are up here, reporting is down here. Okay, so we have got to know, you know, we've got to encourage people to get it up here. Obviously, we want the incidents to go down, the reporting to go up. And so that is one of the measurements, you know, and our reporting has really skyrocketed, you know, 2-3-fold since I began in this office. And you can really, you can look at our website, look at our statistics, it's all there. And so I do think that's a metric. That's not going to fix the underlying issue by any means, but I think that is one important metric. And in fact, when you're looking at schools, I think that's an important metric. You know, have they had 5 reports over the year, or have they had hundreds? Okay, and I know that sounds completely backwards, but you get really worried about if there's only 5 reports, because that means that nobody is coming, and that's just not accurate, you know, in terms of the total incidents that are happening.
I'm going to argue that locker room talk is a measure of success. So this goes back to how people behave is influenced by what they're thinking. What they're thinking comes out their mouths, and how we are talking to each other does matter. And so going back to the subject, you know, I think that's an indicator of success, you know, that there's less hate speech and it's being challenged when it does bubble up. And you know, I mean, it's complex. I'm just throwing that out because it's the title of our session. But I think it matters. It goes back to, you know, how we talk and think and behave are interconnected, and it matters.
I mean, I think it's worth mentioning that, like, a number of athletes have pushed back and said we would never say something like that. And I don't know if that would have happened 20 years ago. I think that there is progress happening. I can't speak to, like, you probably the only person on the panel who really understands the metrics forward. But I do think that a lot of these conversations should have been happening since always. And they're only starting to happen in my lifetime, which feels pretty weird. But I think, you know, like LeBron James calling the president an asshole is kind of a step, right? Like that's a thing.
Here's a deep one. What is wrong with our culture that this was a non-starter in the discussion of suitability for the presidency?
I didn't even hear that.
I'm not going to take that on.
Yes. But it disqualifies him. Absolutely. Because this isn't just, you know, he is reporting a crime. Our president didn't just insult women. He assaults women. He should absolutely be disqualified.
And yes. And the absolute hypocrisy that we have now had April declared, what is it, sexual assault, fighting against sexual assault month by the president. That, you know, this is, I mean, how he speaks, I actually wrote it down so I can say it to you correctly, because I saw this last night, that Trump declared April 2017, the month we sit in, Sexual Assault and Prevention Month. Is that the worst kind of hypocrisy you have ever heard? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that alone should, disqualify him.
Oh, it's true, it's true. Yeah. Thank you. What's wrong with our culture?
I mean, that's what we've been talking about.
Well, I think, you know, it's a big question, but I think he's a product of our culture, and that we voted for him is a product of our culture. And I think we've been touching on that question throughout, which is one of the problems with our culture is that white men hold the power. And they use that power and misuse that power. And we allow that to happen. And we have allowed that to happen ever since this country was created. And so we live in a patriarchal world. This is a world dominated, by white guys. And I don't think even that Trump could have happened if we hadn't had a black president. But, you know, it was a great swing over to the last cries of the white male. And this is essentially the water we've been swimming in. And that's what's wrong with our culture. We don't have equality. We don't have equal voice. I mean, look around. We're white, we're privileged, and then you add white men into the mix. I mean, right now you see every executive order being signed, and there's a bunch of white guys, old white guys standing around. Mm-hmm. And our power in our country has been given to a bunch of old white guys. And they're racists, they're misogynists, and we have to name that and own it. And we are all culpable in Trump's emergence. We are all. We were lazy. We didn't have the conversations. We weren't brave enough. We've all self-selected out into different geographic areas, and we're speaking to ourselves in little echo chambers. So there's a whole lot wrong with this culture. A little bit of passion.
Well, and speaking of passion, and this will be our last question, and it's a theme that was woven through many of them. People like to talk about sex and beauty and attraction and those sorts of things, and it's spring, damn it. How do we speak about that with our friends? How do we talk about it in a way that's okay?
Does it come from love or does it come from hate?
I also think you can look at the actual words you use. I think that, like, your lovers should have agency in your love, right? So, like, it shouldn't all be I, me, mine when you're talking about it, you know? If you find yourself describing your interactions all I, me, mine, and there's no, you know, he, she, hers, theirs happening, you know, that you probably have a problem, like, right from there. Like, you can look at the way you speak, you know? You don't have to get into hate speech. Like, if you only talk about yourself, you're probably not a very supportive or loving partner, and that's sort of where it starts, is like obsession with the self. You know, sort of think. I mean mine.
I feel like somehow I make this point on every panel I'm on. Here it is. Here is, you know, Karuna's, like, hobby horse for the week is sex and pleasure are good and valuable in and of themselves. I hope people are having and talking about great pleasurable sex that may or may not be connected to love. Because I do think that there, you know, intimacy and partnership and love is also, and I hope we're having loving and intimate relationships that may or may not be sexual. And I think we always need to distinguish again reproduction, and there's lots of ways to reproduce besides intercourse sex, and this is kind of the point I somehow keep making over and over again. So how do we talk about sex? You know, talk about what feels good to you, what feels good to your partner. You know, I mean, that's all fine, right? The question is when we get into, like, there's this entitlement and subjectification, you know, kind of, you know, one-sided. You know, that's where we run into some problems.
Well, and certainly from both the education side as well as the investigative side, is this is such a key component because, you know, the cases come and the confusion comes when they are just not talking about it, okay? You know, there's miscommunication. We talk about our consent standard is words or actions that show a mutual understanding to do the same thing, same way, same time. Okay? You can't get that usually, okay, unless you've talked about it, and you need practice doing it, okay? And I do think, you know, anecdotally, in a world in which no one talks anymore and they text, is that, you know, you're not usually going to text, hey, this, that, now, you know, maybe, sure, great, you're not going to be in my office, you know, yes, yay, you're not going to be in my office. But I think there is this problem now where we've lost the ability to have really meaningful conversations about, is this what you want? Is it what you want now? Because yesterday we may have done the same thing, but today it's not okay. And that is a big takeaway from my office, is you have to consent to this time now in this way, okay? And I think that's what gets really lost in that. And so, you know, not only the education piece is, you know, our training folks, they talk, you know, it's literally called, like, let's talk about sex. I mean, that's healthy, that is the way it needs to be. And I have a concern that I have students who from, you know, from high school have never had these kind of conversations, and all of a sudden they come to a college context and they don't know, they don't have skill sets to do this. And obviously you have mandatory training, but I'm sort of working against, you know, sort of 18 years or so of not really having some skills. And so that's challenging.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank our wonderful panel.